see everyone this evening. I have to admit, when Levi said it was time for prayer, I said, "Wait, where's the reading?" I don't know what I expect him to read the whole book of Judges. That was bad on my part. I wasn't thinking, kind of like these questions. It was kind of odd not to have verses and things tied directly to them. So my Bible reads that the book of Judges, it reads the book of Judges. It's plural, and it's important to note that it's plural. These were unique leaders that God gave Israel, these judges. The Hebrew word for judges is deliverer or savior, which I found to be very interesting. Deliverer or savior. There were 12 judges before Eli and Samuel. That's for a total of 14. Six of these were military-type judges, which I thought was kind of interesting. And you're going to get to listen to me try to pronounce these names, so just bear with me. Othniel, Ehud, Deborah, Gideon, Jephthah, and Samson. These were military leaders of Israel at the time. So the time frame of this that's covered in the book of Judges, I found to be kind of interesting and confusing. Barnes thought it was 140 to 160 years. MacArthur thought that it was 350 years. Kaufman thought somewhere around 300, and I've got a slide that says somewhere around 336, 339. I had that from different folks that I read from. So the span is a lot of years, and important aspect to remember, these are not chronological. These are events that were taking place, we believe, and writers believe, many of them were overlapping, taking place at the same time. So that can help some of the, when you start adding up the years that are mentioned, you're out 400, 500, and you got to remember, some of these were being overlapped. They were being occurring at the same time. So there's my introduction. Let's look at question number one. You remind me what I missed.
Dakota answered the last question.
Okay, so Larry, Grant, if you'll take question number one, who wrote Judges? Who wrote Judges? When was it written? What was the author's purpose in writing it?
Okay. The first two questions, they kind of go hand in hand with who wrote it and when it was written. It's not stated exactly who wrote it, but by some of the things that are written throughout the book, you kind of get an idea of perhaps who likely wrote it. And short answer, I guess, there's probably Samuel. But we see at the end of the book that it lists very specifically that it was a time before the kings. So, which kind of lends the idea that it was a time at which when it was written, that it was probably a king in power at the time. Because they say before the kings, at that time, we would say, well, if they didn't have a king, why would they even say that? So it's probably during the time when there was a king. And then also, of course, if you look at chapter 21, verse 25, in those days there was no king in Israel, and they were able to write their minds. And then also in the first chapter there, I think it's kind of interesting, I don't know if this was pointed out or not, but verse 21, but the children of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites who inhabited Jerusalem. So the Jebusites dwell with the children of Benjamin in Jerusalem to this day.
Right.
They also refer to it there as the city of David. So I kind of think it might have been before David was king. So kind of, when there's kings, but before David was a king, which of course kind of leads Saul as a king.
Yes.
And Samuel put Saul in the power. Anointed Saul in the power. So I'd say Saul, or sorry, Samuel, the one who wrote it. And again, that's not really exact, but that's I think it's likely. So it kind of goes with the first two there, Samuel being the author, and then when it was written, probably in Samuel's lifetime, so Saul was probably in power.
Yeah.
Okay, so the last one, the third part there, what was the author's purpose in writing it? There's a lot of things that could be the purpose of writing this. It really kind of shows the people that even though they didn't have a king, God was still looking after. God was with the people throughout this time. They didn't really need a king, but certainly when people were following God, God was looking after them. God was always looking after them, but only when they were following after him. Not when they turned from him, God turned from them and tested them by sending the other lands around them, the people around them against them. And that also kind of gave them a purpose, or just kind of role models to look up to, people who were falling after God were the ones who were really being promoted here, and saying that these were people who were leading Israel, but who were those that were following God.
Yeah, very good. Extensive answer, and you covered a lot of ground. I appreciate that. As you mentioned, who wrote it, the debate, I found the Jewish history, the Talmud, suggests it was Samuel. 2 Samuel 5, verses 6 through 7, is where we see David going to, it was actually basically Jerusalem, but I think it was called Jesse, and overthrowing, running the Jebusites out of Jerusalem and taking over Jerusalem. So we have that. King David finally did that. Barnes agreed that Barnes suggested that the book of Judges might have been written at the same time and by the same author that wrote 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings, which I found interesting as well. Anyone else? What other comments do we have? Awesome.
As far as timing, like you said, it's important to remember that these are not specifically chronological in their order.
Yep.
That was something that, as you study, this is going to be an unusual study because of that, particularly because of what we just went through, in the Gospels not all that long ago, which was pretty chronological. But there's a fellow named Rimmers. He said in his introduction to the book of Judges, in 1 Kings chapter 6, verse 1, it talks about, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign, it was 480 years since the time that they left Exodus.
Mm-hmm.
So that includes the 40 years wandering in the wilderness. Yeah. That would include the 40 years apiece of King Saul and King David's reign. And he would conclude that there was almost, in the time of Joshua, so there's almost 350 years for Judges. And I think that was...
this person thought 336.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think that timing, or that timetable as far as the 1350 BC, that works.
Yeah, and so there's another interesting aspect here.
This little note right here about Naomi to Moab, Ruth chapter 1 and verse 1 is interesting.
And it reads, Ruth chapter 1 and verse 1, "Now it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled that there was a famine in the land, and a certain man from Bethlehem, Judah." So we see, in fact, it was even suggested that the story of Ruth might have actually been originally part of the Judges letter, similar to Judges 17 or 18, and then 19 and 20. There's kind of a series of stories, and that it was suggested that the book of Ruth was originally part of this Judges compilation. So I found that kind of interesting. Anyone else on question number one? One other point I had. I just wrote that. And I thought the author's purpose in writing it, I thought part of it was to show Israel's failures, the consequences, the repentance, and the faithfulness of God to his people, to his people's deliverance. Time and time, as we're going to see, seven times that God let the people fall away. They got into trouble. They realized it. They repented. They called on God. He helped them deliver them. So we're going to see this pattern continue. Anything else on question number one? Okay, question number two. What happened at the end of Joshua, and how does it transition into the beginning of Judges? Trace?
So, at the end of Joshua, which Joshua was a very positively eventful book for the most part, but at the end of it, basically Joshua gathers all the people to Shechem, and he basically makes them, they have a covenant with God that they are going to abandon all their false gods and do the right thing.
Right.
Follow God. And so seemingly, they're on the right foot, they're doing the right thing, and Joshua is also, it's his farewell address, so he's he's basically coping and preparing them for him not being around anymore, but to continue their conquest of Canaan. But in the chapter 2 of Judges, well, even before that a little bit, you know, they kind of start to go downhill, and as soon as Joshua passes, it's just, it goes downhill from there.
Right. So. Right. Yeah. No, I think that's the key. I think that's part of the key aspect is the passing of Joshua and the elders. At the end of Joshua, I didn't write down the text, but it's right here. At the end of Joshua here, you see in chapter 24, verse 31, Israel served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had known all the works of the Lord which he had done for Israel. So I think that's a key aspect right there, Trace. What happened at the end of Joshua, and how does it transition into the beginning of that? Anyone else? Question up, Lauren.
There's a kind of an interesting connection. We'll probably get into this, but I really don't know how it works. But back in Joshua 5, we had the commander of the army of the Lord showing up and talking to Joshua and encouraging him. And here in Judges 2, we have the angel of the Lord, and it appears Joshua is still around, and he tells them that these people, when you fail to do what I said, these people are going to be thorns in your side. So it's kind of interesting that Joshua is bookended by those two visitations.
That's a good point. I didn't see that. I didn't. Mark?
Yeah, along those lines, I found a commentator that pointed out that in Judges 2, that Lauren was just mentioning, when the angel of the Lord comes up, he comes up from Gilgal to Bochim, or Bochim. Gilgal was the place where they were circumcised, they observed the Passover, so it was a place of obedience. Bochim means weeping. So it's sort of like a statement setting up the entire book. The people are moving from a place of service, and they're going to be moving into a place of weeping.
Yeah. Yeah, that's certainly the case. They're going to have some many years of hard work. Anyone? Austin?
Something else, too. Joshua, in chapter 23, as part of his kind of farewell address, if you want to call it such, I think it's verses 5 through 13. We don't have to read through all of those, but the gist of it is that these people that are left in the land, you don't go to them, you don't make marriages with them, you don't intermingle with them whatsoever. But when you get into the book of Judges, in chapter 2, verse 21, it says there, the Lord speaking, I also will no longer drive out before them any of the nations which Joshua left when he died. So the blame here is not just put upon the nations after Joshua died, although they certainly did the things, and they were the ones that intermingled despite Joshua's warning.
The 12 tribes.
Yeah. I said the nations. I got to catch myself.
I see what you meant.
In this study, I got to catch myself. But the 12 tribes, that's what they ended up doing. But the Lord says that was Joshua's mistake. He left the people in the land, and despite his warnings to stay away from them, this was the eventual result that was going to happen.
Yep, that's right. That's right. Anyone else? Question number 2. Let's see. So Israel occupied Canaan, but didn't completely obey God regarding these previous inhabitants. And as you said, Austin, the heathen were allowed to influence God's people. And really, is that any different than today? You know, that's our challenge today, to be a peculiar people, to be separate from the world, to not allow ourselves to be influenced by the world. And that's what happened to Israel. We see, and so many times in the Bible, we see these patterns, we see these things repeated, and we have it right here. Yeah.
To that point, it's interesting that it talks about the fact that it was after Joshua died, and then after the elders that saw the miracles, it was after they died.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a point to be made, a practical point, that it really only takes one generation to turn from obedience to complete disobedience.
Yes.
And that's a lesson that applies to us still today.
And I saw that in a passage somewhere, but it might come up here a little later. Anyone else? Question number two. Question number three, Lauren, if you'd like it, what are the main theological themes in Judges?
Well, Grant mentioned the phrase, I think, that everybody thinks about Judges. In those days, there was no king in Israel, and every man did that which was right in his own eyes. So I think you see that in 17:6 and 21:25, sort of a version of that in 18:1 and 19:1.
Yeah, it wasn't until I started reading like chapter 17, 18, 19, 20 that I started seeing it. I thought that was a verse, that idea, everyone did what was right in there, was only at the end, chapter 21, verse 25. I thought that was the only spot, but it's sprinkled, that concept is sprinkled all throughout Judges. I thought that was interesting.
Right, so that can go both ways. As we see, when Saul became king, it really wasn't supposed to be a king. People were supposed to follow God themselves. So we see here in this book what happens when that occurs, but we see when people don't have that structure and they go the other way.
Mm-hmm.
So we have this kind of cyclical nature of departure from God, we have oppression, and God raises up a deliverer, and then we have blessings for obedience, and that occurs over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of the theme of the Bible as well.
Mm-hmm.
Chapter 19, we really see how wickedness spreads and society degrades to its lowest, and we see the state of man, the condition of man in sin there, and really the human condition there in chapter 19, where we have this horrible scene and all the civil war that ensues and so forth. And then another kind of remote little thing. I have this Haley's Bible Handbook, and it talked about in 4:3, the Canaanites had iron, and that's why they were able to oppress. The Israelites didn't have iron, so maybe a small theological theme is God's ability to overcome whatever a society has for his benefit.
Yeah.
And then we also see that he uses imperfect people.
Yeah, that's right too. Any other themes that someone might have thought of? Austin?
One kept jumping out to me was God's mercy. Because everything that they go through here, is, particularly as far as the oppression is concerned, is this isn't coming out of left field for them. They knew exactly what the punishments were going to be if they failed to stay true to God. They were told over and over and over again, if you leave God, he's going to utterly destroy you. And Deuteronomy is a complete list of all the ways that God was going to destroy them, which he did. So this isn't coming out of left field for them. When they leave God, they fall into oppression. And yet, despite that, God still shows mercy. He hears their cries, and even though they deserve what they're going through because of their sin, he still sends a deliverer. And to me, that's... You see, as Lauren pointed out, some of the most despicable things of man in this book, some of the lowlights of humanity, frankly. But I think above all, and I think that's why it's called the Book of Judges, because the judges are a testament of God's mercy and God's faithfulness to his people Israel, even though they've rejected it and continue to reject him time and again.
I agree. Anyone else? Mark?
One of the themes is the angel of the Lord. 18 times the angel of the Lord comes, and I forget how many times it is in the Old Testament. 59 times in the Old Testament, and 18 are here. And it's interesting because the people are looking for a Redeemer to come, and the angel of the Lord is appearing. And this is not just some angel because he's worshipped at times. Samson's parents worship him. They sacrifice to the angel of the Lord. So it's God. God is appearing. And it's just interesting that in this darkness, where people are looking for a man to come and they're looking for all these different judges, that actually he does come. So he's showing up to his people, even though he is not, it's not yet time for Christ the Lord to come to earth. He is coming and appearing to people.
Good point. Anyone else? Question number three. An aspect of this that I thought was interesting is the geographic regions that are mentioned and covered by these different events. Chapter 3, verses 7 through 31 is that southern region. Chapter 4, verse 1 through 5, 31 is the northern region. Chapter 6, verse 1 through chapter 10, verse 5 is kind of the central region. And these are regions of Canaan where trouble has come up, and now the Lord is trying to, his people have fallen away, they've repented, and now, so you see these different regions, the eastern region, the western region. So this isn't just an isolated spot, I guess is the point. All of Israel, all of Canaan was having trouble being faithful to the Lord. Anyone else on question number three? All right, let's look at number four. What are some of the controversies, criticisms surrounding judges? Malin, would you like to answer that?
Sure, I'll give it a try here. So, I feel like we've already kind of talked about some of the controversies with who wrote it. Samuel, most likely. But, and then as far as when it was written, there's still dependent exactly. It's hard to know. And so there might be some other that I'm not aware of, but I guess the second part of this question is criticism. So you see a lot of violence throughout the verses and blood in this book. And so it's kind of, I guess, hard to read, I guess, at times, and especially, for the young children maybe. So you stay focused on the message and, how can we apply this book to us today for our learning?
That's good. Very good. I appreciate that. Kind of like you said, I had the same kind of note, the amount of violence and death and destruction. And some of it was directed by God, and some of it was just mankind on mankind. So this is another one of those areas where God has endorsed punishment and bloodshed at times. Anyone else? Question number four. Another point I had was the human side of God appointed judges. These God appointed judges and deliverers who delivered, but also demonstrated their human side, their sinful side, and got into trouble themselves. Jephthah's vow to God regarding his daughter and the event with his daughter. That's a difficulty for some and a criticism. Anything else? Question number four. All right. Oh, awesome. I'm sorry.
Well, just a couple. There's one of the controversies / criticism would be how women are portrayed in the book of Judges, both in the positive and the negative. Often people will jump to Deborah or to the woman whose name escapes me that killed the general. She was, so they will point to the positive examples, and then they'll point to maybe negative examples like Jephthah's daughter or some of the other ways that women are mentioned, and either try to prop up or destroy what I think we hold as the biblical viewpoint of that in favor of more modernistic or even to tear down the Bible in general. So that's something to keep in mind as we go through this book to look at that. Might think about the ideas of collective punishment or the ethics of collective punishment, because obviously that's a major theme also in this book. People not being judged, if you will, or destroyed individually, but it's the nation that has to be destroyed. So that's something to consider, something to think about as we go. About what a good response to collective punishment would be. Yeah, that's about it.
All collective punishment. I like that. That's good. Yeah, that's something for us to keep in mind. Anyone else? Question number four. Logan, if you'd like question number five. Why did the Lord see fit to include the book of Judges that shows the people of God in some of their darkest and most wicked past moments? What lessons can we learn from the book today?
So this is true in the Bible in general. It's just kind of exemplified in Judges. And we've studied in previous books of the Old Testament as well. I recall, you know, your oldest son, a lot of he's officiated over some studies, and you know, we've talked about massacres and things like that, killings like that, and how brutal and vivid that kind of imagery is. But these are historical books.
Yes.
The Bible isn't going to hide the ugly parts of Scripture, you know, things that might be unappealing or nasty or you know, dark. And it's in those things that we can learn from. You know, we learn, you see the mistakes that the Israelites make. You know, and that goes for all of the Old Testament. You can learn from them. So.
That's right. No, I think that's a great answer. Anyone else? Question number five. Austin?
I totally agree with Logan's answer there. Just to build upon it or add to it, you know, there's a saying that says that it's victors that write the history, right? But in the book of Judges, the main characters aren't always the winners. They win eventually, but they lose an awful lot too. And I think this book goes a long way to show the transparency of God. The fact that God does not try to hide from his people in later generations. Can you imagine being, you know, some little Jewish boy or girl, and parents sit you down, or you're in the synagogue or wherever, to read Judges for the very first time? You might start thinking, boy, we were the bad guys an awful lot, weren't we? Well, we did an awful lot of things that were wrong. I know I would, and this all happened because they broke the covenant. That would be the point that they would come back to. This is what happens when you break the covenant of God. And the transparency of God shows how evil sin is, but also the mercy of God and what happens when you break God's covenant. So I think this is a great book. I think it further solidifies the divine authorship of the Bible, because there's no human history book that would write history the way that Judges does. And to me, that's really, really powerful.
Yeah, that's a good point. Good point. Bart?
Yeah, and to add just to what you two have said, it tells us we can trust the Bible about Jesus. So the Bible is brutally honest about every man that walked the earth, and they're all flawed. They all have tragic errors and mistakes. And these judges were human and flawed. David was, I love how Samuel is probably writing this book, and he's saying, in those days, everybody did what was right in their own eyes because there was no king. And David's about, or Samuel, rather, is about to get taught a lesson. So Samuel's all optimistic that Saul is going to do a good job.
Mm-hmm.
And he finds out Saul doesn't do a good job. And he weeps and moans and cries about it. And guess who comes next? David. David doesn't do a good job. And then the guy after David, Solomon, doesn't do a good job. They all fail. And so the point of Judges is we need a king, but none of these guys can do it. And who could write that? You know, the Jews, why would they write that about themselves? They're writing a book about their country, their people, and it condemns themselves. It's a condemnatory book. And the idea that people would write that spontaneously, let's write a book that condemns us. Nobody's going to do that.
Right.
And so Judges helps us understand that the Bible is true and that Jesus is working.
Yeah, good point. Very good point. Anyone else? Question number five. I had a couple of notes. It's a strong reminder for God's people through generations that disobeying God has consequences. We've hit around that quite a bit. What lessons can we learn from the book? Prosperity does not mean you're okay with God. Chapter 2, verse 10. Don't underestimate the power or the influence of the world. We need to take that to heart. Churches should not overlook the ability of women to work for the Lord, as Deborah and Jael were. Leaders rise and fall, but God's faithfulness will always endure. You know, and that idea of idolatry spread all through this book. And we got to remember that anything we put before God can become an idol for us today. It can be our jobs. It can be, you know, our family. Just whatever we put before God can be a stumbling block for us. And we have to be aware of that. And I like to think about the faithfulness of Samson's parents. As an adult, Samson made bad decisions that might not have been the parents' fault. So let's keep that in mind. Anything else? Question number five. Question number six. Give a broad overview outline of Judges. Bart, is that you?
So I found one I like a lot. The first two chapters are the introduction, and that has to do with the war not going the way that Joshua and God had commanded, and the Canaanites not being removed. And then chapters 3 through 16 are the middle portion, and there are seven apostasies that occur. And the 12 judges are found up in those apostasies. The first one was Mesopotamia with Othniel the judge. The second one was the Moabites and the Philistines, Ehud, Shamgar. The third apostasy was Jabin, king of Canaan, and that's Deborah and Barak. The fourth is Midian, which Gideon delivers the people, in the fourth apostasy. The fifth apostasy is civil war, and Abimelech, Tola, Jair are the judges. The sixth apostasy is the Philistines and Ammonites, with Jephthah, Ibzan, Elon, and Abdon, the judges. And the seventh apostasy is Samson conquering the Philistines, or driving back the Philistines. So I like that idea. I don't know how accurate that is, yep. But some commentators yep. said, introduction, seven cycles of apostasy, and then conclusion. And the conclusion is two supplements, and both of the supplements are terrible. The Danites turn to idolatry. The tribe of Dan turns to idolatry. And the second supplement is the Levite's concubine being murdered and civil war.
Yeah. Oh, very good. That's pretty elaborate. I had a short version. It was the description of Israel after the death of Joshua until the death of Samson. There's a short version. I like Bart's version better. And I have some other notes. Anyone else have anything to add on? Question number six. Austin?
Someone else, not me, noticed that the period of 40 years makes a common occurrence here.
I saw that.
So there's 40 years of peace under Othniel. There's 80 years of peace, which is 40 times 2, by the way, under Ehud. 40 years of peace under Deborah, 40 years under Gideon, 40 years of trouble under the Philistines, and then 40 years of decline under Eli. So that number keeps popping up over and over again, similar to the 40 years of wandering in the wilderness, perhaps, or other numbers where 40 comes up. So just something interesting.
That's right. Very good. Anyone else? Question number six. I think that covers it quite well. Is there anything else to add by any man? Okay, that ought to be an interesting study. We're gonna see some battles and it's amazing the quantities of people who are killed in different battles. I try to wrap my mind around that. Maybe something like some of the Civil War pictures that we've seen with bodies spread across the Gettysburg and some of those things. It's hard to wrap the line around. Appreciate everyone's participation, and hopefully it was an interesting study, and I'm sure this will be an interesting book for us to consider over the next weeks and months. Don't know, let's remember the announcements that were made.